The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Hello, this is Carrie Lawson, reading You Have Contracted a Deadly Song Virus by Erica L. Satifka. I can tell by the distracted look in your eyes that you're barely paying attention to me. But that's perfectly fine. You're among friends here. Every man, woman, and occasional child who walks through these doors knows exactly what you're experiencing. There's no shame in being one of the people gifted with a forever-repeating piece of music in your head. When this was only a transitory psychological phenomenon, they called it an earworm. But the type we have is a little different. The incorrectly named euterpivirus is caused by prions, which look more like holes than worms. What are prions? Twists of protein in your brain, neither bacteria nor true virus. Historically, most prion diseases were caused by a faulty gene or the consumption of human brain tissue. I hope you haven't done any of the latter. This outbreak, however, seems to stem from an unidentified environmental trigger. The cure? Oh, we'll get to that in a moment. Whatever you were listening to when the prions activated is what you're listening to right now. Maybe it happened at a family wedding after the obligatory playing of YMCA. Or maybe it started in your room while you were enjoying some throwaway electro-pop band, as Elton John put it. You can tell everybody that this is your song. I hope you don't mind. A little song humor. We try to keep things light around here. There are three meals a day to be served at 8, noon, and 6. Don't be late. If you miss too many meals, you'll get a tube down your throat, like the lucky people behind the steel door. You may look through this portal if you'd like. It should go without saying that singing is strictly prohibited, except in the isolation rooms, which can be requested with at least 24 hours' notice. Everyone has a different song, and one would not want to debase their glorious personal anthem with the lowly ditties of their fellow residents. That would be rude. Yes, you can have visitors, as many as you'd like. Well, don't be offended if you don't get any, though, since nobody quite knows how the euterpivirus works or who might be susceptible to it. A few people want to take the chance of being near us. Even the doctors who come around once a week spend as little time here as they possibly can. I'm not sure why. Well, who wouldn't want to spend the rest of their life listening to one transcendent piece of music at the cost of everything else, cradled in the arms of... Sorry, got a bit lost there. Your song may be faint now, but soon it will expand to take up much of the time you formerly spent thinking about politics or troubles at home. You'll realize that everything you once thought was so important is nothing more than a minor annoyance, the buzzing of a fly two rooms away. As your brain slowly molds itself in the shape of your song, you'll develop a peace beyond present understanding and become bathed in a sort of holy innocence. Oh, don't look so horrified. Yes, I know you came here for the cure. The fact is, not long ago, scientists were well into their study of the euterpivirus, and were perhaps a few years away from permanently shutting off our personal songs. will excise the prion-infested auditory center of your brain, they said, and stop it that way. The feedback loop broken. Our songs would no longer fill our souls with the ecstatic joy that blocks all other thoughts. For no thoughts are as true and important as the personal song is to those of us blessed with our beloved, melodious prions. Well, we dealt with those Philistines. We stole their research and skewed the results, leading them down a series of dead ends from which they could never reorient themselves. They finally threw up their hands and declared the Euterpe virus unknowable and incurable. After all, there aren't many of us. Not yet. Truth be told, most of us would rather die than have our soundtracks removed. This is something that the researchers who worked most closely with us learned very quickly. Though, for obvious reasons, their days of researching are over now. We may never know what causes this so-called affliction, but we don't want to. We have our songs, and we have each other. But mostly, we have our songs. Now you must excuse me, for I grow weak. I have not eaten in several days, as the sound of my chewing is like the clanging of a rusty cymbal, interrupting the pure pleasure of my melody. It wasn't bothersome before, but it is now. The doctors say that soon I'll be behind that steel door, nutrients silently pouring into me as I let myself succumb to my song. I can't wait. We think you'll be happy here, or at least content, just like the rest of us. After all, who doesn't like music? The end.
Phoenix Rising, written by Malaya Robin Kawaguchi. Narrated by Warren Keyes. The reporters keep asking how we could possibly have missed them. Little green men in our backyard and the eggheads at Stewart didn't even notice. The press just eats that story up. So when I talk publicly, I start with the fact that we're not SETI. We're astronomers. Plus, the observatory is closer to Tucson than Phoenix anyway. Not to mention, it's hard to notice something that's always just there. I mean, they were here for 1,000 years. My wife was here with me, just shy of 20. And those little green men weren't green. Besides, come on, it's not like we're the only ones who missed it. Yes, okay, we were wrong about that star-shaped petroglyph in White Tank Mountain Park. In retrospect, it's more likely that was a drawing of the alien's craft landing than of supernova 1006. 2020 hindsight and all that. But there are more than 100 miles of abandoned canals outside the city that the archaeologists got wrong, too. Of course, when you look back, their impact was visible. But we were looking forward. Clean house, happy kid, and the whole universe to distract me. They were patient and thorough. Waiting. Yes, they were really good at waiting. But that doesn't mean they didn't interfere. They must have looked like us, or at least had the ability to, because we never noticed the company. Now that it doesn't matter, the historians tell us that the aliens intermingled the whole time they were here. They were outlaws in the desert in the early days, then sheriffs, city planners, businessmen. They made sure the city grew where and in the way it needed to, shaping it to their needs. She changed, the size of her body mirroring the size of her misery. My eyes stayed on the skies. She could not shape me to her needs. It tops 110 degrees about 20 days a year outside of Phoenix, yet it was regularly 15 degrees hotter in the city. Just exactly as if the city had been built as a heat amplifier. As if. And nobody ever noticed except to complain. Never really asked why. We called it an urban heat island and thought a name was an explanation. I never noticed her misery. Never asked why. The heat they stored in those devices under the canals must have been incredible. Building up that close to the city for 1,000 years, and nobody ever saw. It must have felt like 1,000 years to her, alone in a marriage. I don't know. I never saw. They weren't perfect. They made a mistake in March of 1997. Moved a ship into place at the wrong time. Thousands of people saw it, even the governor. It could have been the end of secrecy. It wasn't. Human complacency and insistence on normality triumphed as always. We certainly had our part in that, mocking the witnesses and calling the whole thing ridiculous. A carpenter's square in the sky? Impossible. It was flares, balloons, mass hysteria. Any explanation would do. We looked away. She pulled away. Found someone who would notice her. I wonder where she met him. Jesus, could he have been one of them? And then, of course, the dust storm in July 2011. The wall of grit 80 kilometers wide and more than 1.5 kilometers tall. So thick, no light could escape. Brutal and gorgeous, it captivated the world. It was so cinematic, so otherworldly, so end of days. Even we astronomers took our eyes off the sky. It drew the attention of all of humanity to the wrong place, as it was designed to. None of us looked up to see the sails unfurling. I see it now. In the pictures, she became so beautiful, losing the weight along with the unhappiness. She styled her hair, smiled more. But all I could talk about was missing out on that promotion. Another distraction. And still they waited. They waited until the planet was at the right point in its orbit. Until the right time of day, until the city looked straight across the heavens toward their home, trusting correctly in humanity's intentional ignorance. At least she waited until our son graduated. So now we know. We are not alone in the universe. Hell, until yesterday, we weren't even alone on Earth. We just didn't see them until we were watching them leave, until all of the cameras of the world focused on the sails of their ships as they rode the column of heat away from us, out of our atmosphere to the freedom of space where movement doesn't cost so much. Until everyone on Earth, not just us this time, watched the sky as we were left behind. Until yesterday, we were not alone. I am.
name is Doris Hyde, and I will be reading The Bomb Chaser by Tara Calaby. Disturbing tale, not ideal for children. Once a person died, it took anywhere from 1 to 3 hours before their chip went dark. Body temperature acted as the catalyst. When the corpse cooled enough, the chip entered death mode, deleting all data and the code that held it. If a chip were removed from its body, the time frame was less predictable. Taped to a chaser's underarm or groin, they had been known to stay active for as long as half a day. From there, they could be inserted into a different body, allowing the new host to walk the world as someone else. The hard part was getting the chips in the first place. You needed a dead body, damaged beyond a loved one's recognition. You needed a bomb. That's where the bomb chasers came in. When the bombs fell, all of Cologne was shaken. Blocks away from the impact, windows rattled and flakes of plaster snowflaked to the floor. Greta knew to wait until the whine of aircraft began to fade, but while the earth continued to lurch with dull thunder, she dressed in wool and coarse leather. The knife in her boot was for protection. The scalpel stolen from a ruined surgery was for cutting out the chips. Once the bombing ceased, Greta covered her nose and mouth and walked out into the silence. The streetlights were dark, and the haze of smoke and dust blocked out the moon's weak glow. But the zones of destruction were easy to find. They were the gaps in the once cluttered streetscape, and the places where flames parted the night. She could see that the worst of the attack had focused on the industrial area to her north. She walked south to the place where the families lived. Greta was small and underfed. She couldn't lift rubble like some of the other chasers could. There wasn't time to move bricks one by one, not when the authorities could arrive at any moment, or when the victims' chips were counting down toward their own detonation. She had to go in. When buildings crumpled, they left pockets of space between fallen walls and broken beams, warrens of tunnels that sometimes led to chips and sometimes led to death. Once, she'd been caught in a ruin when a bomb had exploded belatedly in a nearby street, bringing the debris down around her. A uniformed Luftschutzpolizei volunteer had dragged her from the building's remains. Even when tangled around clumps of plaster, her blonde hair had ensured that her chip had been only cursorily scanned. She had been lucky. She had been lucky many times. Greta recognized the mess of rubble in front of her as the broken bones of two large buildings that had been divided into scores of one-room flats. There were several patches of slow-burning fire, but the damage was mostly the result of the bomb's direct hit. The left building was razed, its stone shattered into slate-colored sand. The right struggled to stand, its back wall upright, but amputated at the second floor. There was no sign of the Orpo, so Greta crawled inside. The first time Greta had seen a dead body, she had cried for the woman's lost potential and endured weeks of nightmares about the unnatural angles of the corpse's legs. Now she was hardened. In her first tunnel, she found the body of an elderly man who had been skewered by a falling beam. His blood was still wet, and it coated Greta's gloves as she cut into his wrist, removing the chip and then wiping it down before taping it to the inside of her leg. She could see the lower half of a wrinkled arm nearby, probably belonging to the man's wife, but there was no way to reach it. She wriggled out and found another path. The child's body appeared undamaged. There was no blood, no broken limbs, just a stillness that Greta knew too well. She checked for a pulse before cutting, keeping her gaze away from the young girl's face. Her heart pounded with hopeful excitement. Children's chips were rare finds. She had been searching for a girl that young for months, but every time the bombs fell, she had found only dead adults instead. When Greta emerged from the building, four chips taped to her leg, she could hear the sound of the Feuerschutzpolizei making their way through the crumbling streets. They were not far away, so she lit the trails of kerosene that she had poured out through her tunnels and ran until she heard the first explosion. Then she unwound the scarf from her face, brushed off her clothes, and walked sedately into the night. The Jewish houses were watched by cold men with loaded guns, but on the nights where the sky was torn by aircraft, it was easy to slip through a hole in a wire fence. Greta's contact was a doctor who had long since been forbidden to practice. Other bomb chasers sold the chips to criminals, but their value to Greta was far beyond price. "The small one's for my sister," she told the doctor, pressing it into his waiting hand. "There's one there for you, too, if you want it." His smile was sad. "I'm needed here." Greta understood. tell my family I love them and to get out tomorrow night. She couldn't say goodbye in person. They'd beg her to leave when they did, to be safe. But every chip Greta found was a chance at life, an opportunity to climb out from beneath the rubble of the war. She would stay as long as she was able to, save as many people as she could. And when the bombs finally came for her, she would greet them with her arms outstretched and chase them into the night.
This is Dan Oliver reading, If the Apocalypse Happens and CNN Isn't There, Did It Really Happen? By Anya Oh. The apocalypse happened to Singapore at 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on a Thursday. The bridges linking the tiny island state to Malaysia were severed in half. The few cars on the still existing side of the bridge crawled to a halt before the void. There were screams. Images were tagged on Instagram. Some went viral. Hashtag ApocalypseLAH. The international news media descended. Sweating in the equatorial heat, they took photographs and interviewed local people. It's the end times, said Sarah, age 54. Maybe Singapore is only the start. The start of the whole world becoming a void? Yeah. Why did it start with Singapore? Why not? Maybe a higher power wanted to punish them. Punish them? What for? Claiming that their version of Nasi Lemak is better. Who knows? Was it better? What? The Nasi Lemak. No, no. It was probably aliens, said Eliza, age 36. Why would aliens decide to make a pinpoint strike on an island state that was careful to be friends with everyone? Dunno. Maybe it was a preemptive strike. Before diplomatic attempts? Yeah. I was homesick today or I would have been working in Singapore, said Mahmoud, age 41. Scary. Did he think it was aliens? No, la, what aliens? Why would aliens attack Singapore? Aliens would attack New York. What did he think happened? I heard the Singapore Gamin has a secret government lab in Fusionopolis. Maybe something went wrong. But Fusionopolis wasn't a secret. That's what they want you to think. They'll be back. Maybe they already are. Where? Dunno. Did you people check Antarctica? My friends live in Singapore. This is so horrible. All those people, said Leanne, age 24. What did she think happened? Terrorists! No terrorist faction had claimed responsibility. Secret terrorists! You really have to be careful nowadays. This is the darkest timeline, so maybe they just moved to another one, said Tony, age 32. They? It's something the government might have done. Through Fusionopolis? It's a very precise disappearance, don't you think? Right around the boundary. Move to where? I don't know. Somewhere where the world isn't going to end in 12 years. Why do you think the world is ending in 12 years? Isn't that what you people think? No. The 12 years was just the UN saying, well, that's what I heard on Facebook. Singapore just moved on ahead of time, that's all. They're always like that. After a week, the void disappeared and left open sea in its wake. No further voids occurred. It now appeared safe to commiserate with moderate displays of grief. Flowers were left to rot on the severed edge of the causeway and outside shuttered embassies in other countries. There was a token minute of silence during a UN council meeting. The international news media decamped gratefully away from the humid heat and returned to covering carnivorous political arenas. Global maps were tentatively altered. There was not much to alter. There had been 5.6 million people where the void was, but death was just a number. In other areas of the world where the apocalypse had already happened in messier ways, life crabbed on among IEDs and carpet bombs, in indigenous communities with uranium-poisoned water, along rivers choked with dead fish. No one of note took photographs. There were no interviews.
Kim O'Callaghan.
And I'm John Franz.
And this story is called A Wish by Eduardo Albert. A wish? I thought there was supposed to be three. The genie breathed on his fingernails, apparently inlaid with diamonds, and polished them on his tuxedo-clad chest. And then he turned to me, shrugged, and grimaced in a way that was meant to suggest sympathy at my situation, but instead hinted at the sort of glee a real estate agent knows when he's suckered a first-time buyer into putting an offer in on a house that is beyond his means.
What can I say?
The genie made a moo with his rose-pink lips.
It's our new terms and conditions. If it was up to me, I'd be happy to give you the traditional three wishes. But there you have it. One is all we're allowed to grant these days.
I began to grin. I had an idea. But before I could speak, the genie said,
and if you start thinking of using your wish to ask for more wishes, that's specifically forbidden under Article 4, Subclause 36 of the new code.
Oh, my face fell.
Sorry.
The genie did not look at all sorry. It glanced at its watch.
I know you want to give this some thought, but I have an appointment to keep. I really will need your wish within the next, 2 minutes.
2 minutes! I squeaked. I'd spent a lifetime tracking down a genie, and now that I found one, I had to give him my single wish within 2 minutes.
1 minute 40 now, I'm afraid.
The genie said. My mind closed up on itself. I couldn't even think of anything. I couldn't even remember my original three wishes, which I'd spent years crafting for maximum advantage, personally, socially, and globally. The genie began tapping a diamond fingernail on its Rolex. That's really not helping, I said.
Oh, sorry,
said the genie. It smiled brightly.
30 seconds.
I stared at the roof, the ceiling, the floor of the cave, struggling for my single wish. It had taken me so long.
Time's up,
began the genie. Got it! It was my turn to smile. I wish for a genie detection device.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.